Support for podcasting on KBIA comes from Grindstone Fitness Studio, a full-service gym offering equipment for more traditional exercise such as weight and cardiovascular training, as well as specialized classes. Choices include personal training, spinning, yoga, Pilates, and more. All classes taught by certified professionals. More information is available at 443-4447. Grindstone Fitness Studio, 3005 Chinaberry Drive in Columbia.
From KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute, on air and online, this is Intersection.
Hello and welcome to Intersection, where people and ideas meet online and on KBIA. I'm Ruben Stern, filling in for Ryan Fumuliner. On Tuesday, Columbia voters selected three school board members and approved a $50 million bond issue. The funding is part of a 10-year plan that includes a new elementary school and other improvements, with the goal of eventually getting rid of the district's classroom trailers. As the district moves forward, a new superintendent will be at the helm. Peter Stiepleman has been the district's assistant superintendent of elementary education, and now he's going to take on the role of district superintendent when Chris Belcher retires at the end of June. Peter Stiepleman joins us as our guest today to discuss his new job and his vision for public education in Columbia. Peter Stiepleman, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Glad to have you in the studio today and get a chance to talk through some of these issues.
Yeah.
For those of you in our audience, we'd like to hear from you as well. Maybe you have some kids in public school in Columbia. If so, what's on your mind, and what would you like Columbia's incoming superintendent to keep on his mind as he takes on this new job? Give us a call, 573-882-8925, to join our discussion on air. You can also join our live web chat by going online to kbia.org, click on the Programs tab, and choose Intersection. Peter, I want to start off. You started in New York, you went to California, and now you're in Columbia, Missouri. Why is this the right place for you to be a superintendent?
I actually was going to ask you if I could actually call in as a parent as well.
We'll let you do that, absolutely. You have kids in the school,
that's right, we'll talk about that too. Sure. To be the superintendent in Columbia, Missouri really is a dream. You have an incredibly supportive community. Having worked in the Oakland Public Schools, you can see that families are incredibly supportive for what they want for their children. But here in Columbia, everyone acknowledges that we're really an asset for the community. And so businesses, you know, choose to stay or to relocate here. The university, certainly, and Stevens and Columbia College, they use the community, as the schools, as a way to recruit. Because when you come here, you know that there are great schools here.
And you're a parent. I mean, this is a good place for your kids?
I'm a good example of that, wanting to or choosing to move to Columbia because of the schools. And so my wife teaches in the English department. She's a professor there. And when she was offered the job here and one other job opportunity, and when we came to Columbia, we thought, this is where we want to raise our family. And so we have not had any regrets. We're now 10 years here, and we've put down our roots, and we'll be here.
Right. What do you hope to accomplish as superintendent when you get into the top job?
So for me, I sort of characterize it with three words: enrichment, achievement, and opportunity. And enrichment really is about making sure that kids have opportunities, everything from taking a foreign language to taking classes, music classes, to be involved in sports, those types of things. Those activities and classes that really give kids a perspective or a thought about what their career might be outside of public education or outside of the pre-K through 12. In terms of opportunity, that really is about the access kids have to school. And so for us, in establishing a culture that really values a student and a student's background, and that we say to ourselves, you know, it's not about a child may disrupt the school environment. And that happens quite a bit. And I would imagine if you're going to have phone calls, that if we have calls, that some of them are about, how do I make sure that my child is given every opportunity to be successful, and that those kids who interrupt learning are not allowed just to come right back? Because that's sort of a question that we get. And so I want to know that we have practices in place that sort of restore the environment, sort of restorative practices that look at how do we restore the environment so that kids are valued and honored. And it's not about just suspending a kid for 10 days. It's about really figuring out what is it that this child needs. And then the last is achievement. As a district, we excel in many areas, and then in some areas, we continue to struggle. So the way that the state sort of gives us a report card, it's called the APR, your annual performance report. And within that annual performance report, there are lots of categories. There's your overall achievement. How do students do in English language arts and math and science and social studies? But then also, how does your super subgroup perform. And your super subgroup are your ELL students, your second language learners, your Latino students, your Black students, your free and reduced lunch students, and students who receive special education services. So they all get kind of put together as one group. And as a district, if you were to think about things from a 100-point scale, we earned 35 out of the 100 points for how students perform, whether how they did on the test, the kind of progress they make over time, or individually their own growth over time. That's a problem for us in Columbia. So a big priority for us is going to be about the achievement of all students, and particularly that super subgroup.
Right. Well, that gives us a lot to parse through for the... No, this is good. That's a good opening.
We have an hour, right?
To get through. We've got plenty of time. So again, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ruben Stern, filling in for Ryan Fumuliner. And today we're talking with Peter Stiepelman, who will take over as Columbia Public Schools Superintendent on July 1st. We invite you and our audience to join the conversation as well. What concerns or ideas do you have about public schools in Columbia? Give us a call, 573-882-8925, or you can email us, intersection@kbia.org. You can also tweet us. Our handle is @IntersectKBIA. And we'd like to remind you that you can watch Intersection as streaming video online during our live conversations every Monday afternoon at 2 at KBIA.org. Along with that video, you can join our online chat room. Just go to KBIA.org, click on the Programs tab, and choose Intersection. Again, that's Mondays at 2 online at KBIA.org. I want to walk through the three points that you made. We'll start with the achievement one that you kind of ended with there. How do you encourage achievement for all students across the board? That's a tough one for a school district to crack.
Yeah. Well, your first thing is about making sure the kids actually get to school. And so when you think about that APR was describing, one of your areas is attendance, right? So we want to make sure that kids have attendance. Now, the way that they measure attendance is what percentage of your students have 90% attendance or better? And you'd think 90%, that's not that hard. That's 17 missed days to receive 90% attendance. As a district right now, we only have 85% of our kids have 90% attendance or better. And we've got kids who miss 20, 30, 40 days of school during a school year. That's a big part of just getting kids to school, because if you're not in school, you're not learning. You're not giving us an opportunity to make sure that you're learning the content.
And how does that compare with other districts?
That's a good question. Most of our comparison districts have similar. We compare ourselves to Independence, for example. They've had actually declining attendance over the last 3 years and declining graduation rates as well. And so we've had increases in each of those areas, and that's because we've put systems into place to make sure that a kid who drops out, we figure out a way to get them either back into school or in some sort of alternative programming. And then kids who are not in school for attendance reasons is that we have different sort of thresholds for when we either visit the home, call the home, send the letter. But, you know, I know that if I've missed 20 days of school, the letter isn't really what's motivating me to get to school.
What causes a kid to miss that many days of school?
There are so many different factors. It could be that we have about 160, almost 170 homeless students in our district. So these are students who are either living in a shelter, in a hotel, a motel, doubled up on someone's couch, or living with an aunt, or doubling up even anywhere in town. So it's difficult to get to school. Now there's a federal law called the McKinney-Vento Act that says we will provide transportation at our cost wherever you live. We will provide breakfast and lunch for free, and we'll make sure that there are no barriers to your enrollment. But you have to let us know where you are so we can get you to school. Then we also just have a highly mobile community, and that means that we're about 20-something percent of our students, where they started is not where they finished in the school year. And so that often means that a family has moved, they spend a few days getting settled in their new house, and then they go to their new school. Some of our schools have 30% mobility, where one-third of the kids at that school did not start there, nor did they finish there. And so that, as you might imagine, creates quite a challenge for a school community to make sure that everybody's getting what they need.
Well, a third of the students.
A third. So you have some schools that have 3% mobility, right? Nobody leaves, right? And that's a Ridgeway, where it's completely lottery-based. And so those who start there typically finish there after that school year and then all the way up to fifth grade. And so then some other schools where in a given class you could have even higher rates of mobility.
Right.
So consistency matters.
So you mentioned that you're catching some of these students before they drop out and trying to intervene that way. How are you doing that?
Well, it depends on what level you're talking about. So, because dropouts, certainly you don't usually see at the elementary age.
Of course.
But in the elementary schools, we have a system that is called response intervention, which is really just about a way to say, how do I make sure that I meet you think of it as like a triangle. How do I make sure that I'm meeting, if you know, 80, we would imagine that 80 to 85% of our kids are just really, they're meeting the, they're learning what they need to be learning. They're performing well in assessments. They're doing fine. And then you have maybe about 10% of your kids who just need additional service, right? And so that may be an additional person who comes and reads with that child, or the classroom teacher himself or herself is spending some additional time within that day to do like a double dose where they have done their reading group and then they come back for one more session. Or a tier three where you're really getting more intensive. It's not special ed, but it is something where somebody else or the intensity or the frequency is increased. We're doing those things now. The middle school schedule is set so that it will include response intervention. I think teachers would probably agree that that they need some more guidance on how to do that and how to do that well. And so that's going to be our work. And then at the high school level, I know that Battle High School and I know that Hickman, they have time during the day, and I think Rockbridge as well, they have time during the day where kids, based on their current grades in certain courses, will go and meet with an additional person to get some additional support. So these are, and then you have an incredible counselor system, you have incredible administrative staff, and then the teachers themselves who really build relationships with the kids to say, let's figure out how to support you.
Right.
Okay, one of the other things that you talked about is opportunity. So achievement of students, then the idea that students would have opportunity within the district to do what?
So I think of it, the word opportunity or opportunity gap for me is, what are those barriers that are limiting a kid's access to school or access to programs? So, for example, 2 years ago, under the leadership of our assistant superintendent for secondary, she noticed that the three high schools had three different course catalogs. And within those course catalogs, there were prerequisites to take classes. Some had no prerequisites, some had significant, and some had just random. And so she wanted to eliminate those kinds of prerequisites because it should be about whether or not that student believes he can take the class, or whether or not a teacher advocates for that student to take a class, or that parent says, I'm here to, you know, I want my child to take that class, and it shouldn't be necessarily about prerequisites. And so we've worked with the Equal Opportunity Schools out of Seattle to figure out ways so that we could increase the enrollment in AP courses, for example, or honors courses, and then support kids while they're in those classes. So that's an opportunity gap type of issue. Also, it's we talked about a little bit about attendance. That is a real opportunity gap type of thing. And then the last is just discipline. You know, do we have the mindset, or do we have a more flexible mindset that it isn't just about you did this or you go away for this amount of time? Because you might expect that if a kid misses 10 days of school, especially at the secondary level, the opportunity to recoup what you missed is slim. And so you've essentially said to this kid, when you give that kid a 10-day suspension, goodbye. And so we want to say there's a different way. Now, I totally get that if a kid is violent or a kid has done something that they can't be in school, that's fine. But then what do we provide in terms of an alternative opportunity, an alternative school for that 10-day suspension so they're not missing learning and so they can be still considered at school? And so our district has created such a program. It's called the ACE program, where students can go to school. They have teachers there. They're not allowed at their school, right? And then they have a transition meeting back to school. But they didn't miss 10 days worth of learning.
Right. And that makes a lot of sense in terms of making sure that students get an education, even if they're pulled out.
It's our obligation to make sure that every student does.
Interesting. The third thing that you talked about is enrichment opportunities. And what exactly does that entail within the district?
So right now we have about 20% of our kids participate in take foreign languages or participate in music and fine art type of things. And so for me, that's a particular interest because when I think about 21st century learners, for which we're in the 14th year of the 21st century, right? So it's no longer about like Y2K, what do we do? It's like 14th year. What haven't we done yet that we should have been doing? And so when you think about languages, for example, and I'm sure my friends who are German professors will now be upset with me. But the truth is that German is not a language necessarily that is growing. But Mandarin Chinese and Spanish, these are Arabic, these are languages that we think that students should be learning. And so we know that there's a relationship with the Confucius Institute here on campus that is promoting Chinese instruction and is doing a nice job of that. We are part of the Americas. And if you think about Texas and Arizona and California and even mid-Missouri, where there's a burgeoning Latino community, for instance, we used to have about 660 second language learners. We're now up to 990 in only 4 years. So we continue to grow. And, of course, that's refugee community as well, but certainly Spanish speakers as well. So for me, I think that's important. That's enrichment, or maybe it's part of the core now. I'm not sure. But also enrichment is about providing choice and opportunities for families. For example, we have Lee Arts Integrated School here in our community. We have the Ridgeway IGE School, Individualized Guided Education. It's a multi-age model. And then we have Benton STEM, Science, Technology, Engineering, and Math. So these are three choice schools that you can apply to as part of a lottery. Tonight at our board meeting, we're going to talk about, continue the conversation about how we are going to open up a nature school in conjunction with the state of Missouri in Rockbridge State Park. This will be for 100 students, fifth graders, who will spend their year in Rockbridge State Park as part of their learning. It's pretty fabulous, I think, very innovative. Last week, I went to North Kansas City area and learned about the CAPS program there. And that's a consortium of five school districts, Liberty, Park Hill, North Kansas City, Kearney, and what they do is that students who are seniors do internships, whether they're in IT firms or in factories, or where they follow a strand of interest. They spend 4 hours at high school and then 4 hours working and doing an internship. And these are students who were incredibly poised, incredibly enthusiastic about, you know, I wasn't the best student. I didn't really care about, you know, my mythology paper, of which I said, you know, my wife teaches in the humanities, so you might want to, you know, tone it down on the not seeing the value of that. But they also said, when I was part of this team doing this work, whether it was designing a website or creating an app for this athletic apparel company, they started to think about not just college, but what their careers were going to be after college, because it isn't just about getting into college and finishing. For us, it's making sure the kids are also thinking about what their career is going to be afterwards.
Right. I want to come back and talk more about that.
Sure.
First, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA, the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ruben Stern, filling in for Ryan Fumuliner. And today we're talking with the next Columbia Public Schools superintendent, Peter Stiepelman, about his vision for education in Columbia. We'd love to have you join the conversation as well. What would you put on the new superintendent's to-do list? Give us a call, 573.
It's a plate, not a platter.
Yeah. Well, you know, at least for the first year, let's say. 573-882-8925 is our number. You can also email us, intersection@kbia.org, and you can also tweet us. Our handle is @intersectkbia. Peter, I want to get back to some of these policy things, but before we do that, I just want to ask you, why go into teaching? Why, superintendent, why do you want to do this?
It's about service, truly. It's about wanting to leave this world a better place than from where you came. And for me, it's about living out ideals, having the opportunity to affect a school culture and a community in a positive way. When I think about our goals, I subscribe to this cradle to career. I'm not sure if on the intersection you've had the opportunity to meet with Phil Peters, who is currently director of Cradle to Career. But this idea,
we haven't, but we'll look him
I
up.
Think that might be a good opportunity, because it's really about this community coming together to support children, to say that all kids are going to enter kindergarten ready. Right, that all kids at third grade are going to be reading on grade level, that all kids are going to make that smooth transition into middle school and then out of middle school, and then they're all going to graduate. That can't be just the schools, right? We have kids, and this is not an excuse. This is just a reality. We only have them 13% of their day, right? And so we know that there's a lot more of their time spent out of school than it is inside of school. And so how do we engage our community? And I think that that's a particular skill of mine. I enjoy connecting people and connecting our values and our goals with those of our community.
Then why the school system? I mean, why teaching and why education?
Oh my gosh,
what?
I mean, I can't think of a profession more important than to be a teacher. And so I never really thought that I would move into administration, truly, but it seemed to happen. And so you always feel like you can have a greater impact when you move into an administrative position. But there's nothing more important, I don't think. It's, you know, when I'm at Lucky's and I see this girl who is in my third grade classroom, she's just working there, you know, she's in her junior year now. And I say, so what do you remember? And I remember that song that you sang about the boy in the glasses. And it was like, Don't Laugh. It was a song called Don't Laugh at Me.
You're going to sing a little bit for us?
You want me to?
Sure.
We have. That's right. I'll be here all hour. But it's like, don't laugh at me. Don't call me names. Don't get your pleasure from my pain. Deep inside, we're all the same. We all have hope and care and love. Don't laugh at me. I mean, the fact that this kid at 8 and now is almost 17 carries that and saw value and remembers that. There's nothing more important. Or when my wife and I, we were in the Bay Area a couple of years ago, and we went back to the neighborhood where I first started teaching, which was not even a transitional neighborhood. It was kind of a rough neighborhood. And we went to this taqueria, and we walked in. And this girl says, "Are you Mr. Stiepelman?" And I said, "Yeah." And she said, "You were my third grade teacher, and I'm only working here right now, but I'm putting myself through college. You made me believe I could do that." And we're like crying, and you know, like what better profession could you have? That even if I never ran into that girl, you know, that I had that kind of impact, and I hope to inspire others to do similar work.
Well, it's interesting. You say, you know, you hadn't thought about going into administration necessarily, and here you have had a fairly meteoric rise.
I mean, I'm worried about the meteoric fall.
But I mean, really, 2 years as an assistant principal, 2 years as a principal, 2 years as an assistant superintendent,
Four as the assistant super.
Okay, so you took over in 2010 for that job. Sorry, I got the math wrong there. So 4 years of that, and now, so 8 years later, you're the top dog in the district.
I am leading an incredible team, and I'm surrounding myself with those who we met yesterday for a little while on Sunday. And they said, our job is to filter and focus. We're going to help you filter and focus, because I think that's one of our biggest issues as a district, is that there's so many programs that we see value, where we see value, and there's so many things we want to do as a community because we believe that they're worth pursuing. But until we really think about how does, you know, program X fit into our goals for enrichment, achievement, and opportunity, is it worth pausing for a moment on that one? So filter and focus is an admirable goal for them, because I get really excited about the many ideas that people have.
Yeah, we've seen that in the last 20 minutes here. No, it's so great. Okay. There's a lot of this energy, and I think that is interesting. In terms of your mind, like, what are the things that you most would want to focus on at this point?
So for me, a big focus is not to, I'm completely committed to all kids. Don't get me wrong. I also know as a community, we are rapidly urbanizing. I'm not sure how many years you've been in town.
Really. 11.
11. So this is my 10th year. When I started at West Boulevard, our district was about, I don't know, 30-something percent free reduced lunch. This year, according to our January data, we're at 46% free reduced lunch. So that means almost one in every two kids, not just is eligible, is actually participating in the free reduced lunch program. And we know that number is lower at the high schools because not all kids will identify and participate. And so let's say one in every two kids is participating in free lunch. That is significant for us as a district. That brings about a number of challenges when you're talking about a kid from a fragile family, or if you associate free lunch with poverty, and some do and some don't based on the definitions. So for me, that's an incredible focus for my work. And I think probably what was attractive to the board, although you'd need to ask them, but being bilingual, having worked in the Oakland Public School for 6 years, having that experience and that understanding about if we don't support, especially our second language learners in this first generation, what will happen down the road is that those kids, their kids, you know, 15 years from now, or let's say 10 years from now for some, they won't necessarily feel that they are a part of their home culture, nor do they feel, they'll feel somewhat rejected by the dominant culture that's already here, and then will choose a different type of family setting, and that's typically gangs. And so, you know, all these things are coming together in this sort of perfect storm of possible, or at least it's a harbinger of what could come if we don't sort of think about that and focus on that. So for me, it's about the fact that we have to come to terms that we're urbanizing. And the United Way recognizes that, Cradle to Career recognizes that, I think the university recognizes that, and our community as a whole. I mean, if you see all the social, the agencies that exist to support our most fragile, we're a resource-rich community. We take care of our own. That group is growing.
Right. And was that urban situation what got you into teaching in the first place?
So, yeah, well, so my story is that, I mean, the true story, but the way that I tell the story is that I was working in San Francisco for an insurance company. I was working for a subsidiary of Transamerica. And one day in the mail, this yellow postcard came in the mail that said, drop everything and read day, dear. in a Berkeley public school. And so I brought a book that my in-laws had written. My father-in-law was born in Hong Kong, grew up in Shanghai, which was particularly important because to have a British passport meant probably would save his life because the Japanese occupied China at that time. And so he was able to get on a boat and get to London. So he and my mother-in-law wrote some stories from his childhood, just sort of folk tales that he remembered his mother telling him. And so this one was called The Beggar's Magic. And the story, the themes are about charity and generosity and not to be greedy, like old Farmer Wu, right? and there's a great illustration of Farmer Wu just looks like a pig, and the illustration is just perfect. So I read this to this third grade class in Berkeley, and children were so animated, and they were so interested in asking me tons of questions that I went back to my cubicle and said, I think I want to be a teacher. And so that's what kind of got the bug. My father is the son of immigrants, and he grew up in Queens, and he didn't grow up with much. And we used to go back there and do some tzedakah, charity work. Tzedakah also means justice, but in his neighborhood. And so I was raised with the values of service, and then to be able to just get such a rush out of being present in front of these kids just sort of sealed the deal.
Right. And yeah. So what did it take for you to actually become a teacher at that point?
So then, the University of California, Berkeley was running a program called CalPIP, which was right at the same time that California legislature had passed a class size reduction law. So no classroom in California, kindergarten through third grade, could have more than 20 students. So as you might expect, that there was a major rush for, they needed teachers. And then they really needed teachers in those really hard schools because now there were openings at the more desirable schools, and your most tenured teachers said, it's been real, best of luck. So I was hired pretty quickly by the Oakland Public Schools. I went to school at night and on the weekends, but I started teaching almost immediately. And I remember them handing me a key and saying, you're trailer C, good luck. I mean, nobody walked me out there. I didn't have a class roster. In fact, there was somebody who had been living underneath the trailer trying to siphon off the gas, I guess, for like heat or something. And so there had been some damage to the trailer. I mean, it was just really sort of what? And I remember kids just starting to show up. I'm in your class. One teacher sent a kid over to my class that just with a note, I remember his name, but I want to say it. So-and-so is now in your class. It was just that teacher had arbitrarily decided this is not going to work out for me, so he's now in your class. That was a pretty startling.
And how did you figure it out? I mean, what did you?
Well, I had a great mentor. Berkeley was a great program. We as a cohort supported each other, but then there was also mentorship that was provided. I'm sure I was not fabulous. I'm certain I wasn't. I was at a year-round school because now you couldn't have class sizes higher than 20. They didn't have the facilities for that. So I was it was a school of about 750 kids, but only room for 550. And one year I was actually a roving teacher. I mean, I had my 20 kids, but every 3 weeks we went to a different classroom to occupy the space that a teacher had gone out for the 3 weeks vacation. So it was just stunning. But I figured it out. I mean, I had great mentorship and, I studied hard.
Cool. Let me remind everyone, this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ruben Stern, filling in for Ryan Pumuliner. Joining me today is Peter Stiepelman, who was recently selected as the next superintendent of Columbia Public Schools. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back after that. But in the meantime, if you want to give us a call, you can join our conversation as well and bring your questions or concerns about the schools to the conversation. Our phone number is 573-882-8925. You can also email us. Our email address is intersection@kbia.org. Or you can tweet us. Our handle is @IntersectKBIA. We'll be back in a few minutes, so stick around. We'll be right back. And welcome back. This is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ruben Stern, filling in for Ryan Femuliner. With me in the studio is Peter Stiepelman. He is currently the Assistant Superintendent for Elementary Education for Columbia Public Schools, but he'll be taking over as superintendent starting July 1st. For those of you in our audience, you can join our conversation as well. Do you think kids in Columbia Public Schools are getting a good education? Share your thoughts on that or anything else that you want to talk about related to the schools. Our phone number, 573-882-8925. You can also email us, intersection@kbia.org, or you can tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @intersectkbia. You can also join our online chat. Just go to kbia.org, click on the Programs tab, and select Intersection. We've covered a lot of ground already, and we're going to come back to some of that, too. We're going to talk about some more public school initiatives. But I want to get to a comment from our chat room, a question from one of our audience members here. Why would parents want to send their kids to public schools versus private schools? What do you think Columbia Public Schools puts above the other options these days? There's a lot more to the question, but that's basically the gist.
Sure.
Of it. Why public school when there are other options?
You know, we have neighbors and friends who have chosen a different path for their kids and not the public school. And for me, I look at it from a almost a business standpoint of, I want to make it incredibly difficult for you to choose a private school over our public schools. And so I can't answer the question about why someone would choose one over the other, because I think you make personal choices, whether it's about the religious curriculum that some of our parochial schools have, there's a philosophy of Montessori that is different from what we have in our current right. schools. And so I think you have to choose what's best for you and your family. What I can guarantee for you is that we're going to give you the best education, your kid's going to be valued, and your kid is going to be in a school that reflects what our community looks like and what society looks like. And that you don't always get that in a private school. You will get that in a public school.
Yeah. Let me get to some more of the part that was in the question
sure,
here.
Sure, sure.
So in addition to that part, specifically the comment, how can Columbia Public Schools work to allow teachers more time to teach and not as much time spent just making sure students don't do the things they shouldn't? So, I mean, a lot of time, you know, maintaining control instead
of teaching
in the classroom.
Yeah, classroom management is a huge part of...
So how would you sell CPS to parents on that issue and to address that?
Right. So one of the things I would ask parents to do when they're engaging their schools, right, is to ask questions about how will my child be challenged? It certainly was a question we asked as parents, even though I'm in the district. And so I would expect anybody to ask... I want to tell you about my child. I also want to learn what you found out about my child. And so what kind of program can you put together for my child? And so that includes, I was telling you a little bit about RTI, Russell Boulevard, for example. They have a time during each day where children who are working above grade level, will go and, I wouldn't call it tracking. It is more of a flexible group where they will go and do a project together, whereas kids who may be in that tier two will also then be in a smaller group with a professional working on whatever skill deficit that child has. And so it's really about engaging that school and asking, how are you going to make an educational program that meets my child's needs? But certainly classroom management within any part of the public or private schools is a part of school that a number of our teachers, when they're first-year teachers, are a little bit shocked by how much time they spend making sure that everybody is doing what they're supposed to be doing. But that's also a part of school, I think, especially at the elementary age. It's about making sure that kids have that social-emotional growth and that they learn how to work in a team, how to share, how to set a goal and monitor the progress towards that goal and then see if they completed that goal. And if they didn't, what do they need to do or what kind of reflections would they have about why they didn't? And that has to do with a lot of conferencing with adults as well and conferencing with their peers. And so I could keep going. So I'll just
let me flip the question around a little
sure.
bit. I mean, what about you as a parent with your kids? I'm guessing your kids are in the public schools. Is
they
that
are.
Right?
Yes.
So where do they go and how do you manage that as a parent?
Sure. So my son, my oldest, was with me at West Boulevard, had a fabulous experience there, amazing teachers, amazing program. And then when I got the assistant superintendent job, and was tasked by the board to enforce their policy on transfers, I could no longer allow my child to go to West Boulevard because that was essentially a transfer. So I couldn't sit with you if you were a parent and say, I'm sorry, I can't allow you to have a transfer to school X and then myself be able to. So then my child moved to his home school, and I'll just leave it at his home school if that's all right.
Mm-hmm.
And so we definitely were engaged parents about that my child's is not – nor should any child be the teacher's assistant, right? So what do you do to make sure that our child, as well as every other child in the school, is working at his or her grade level, whether that be above or below, and what opportunities can we do as parents to help? Because we know that that's a challenge for all teachers, that they have 25 kids or fewer or a little or more. But yeah, no, I mean, it's just about having good communication and being able to talk about you're your child's first teacher. You know your child's strengths and interests, and being able to share that with the teacher, having that teacher be receptive to that, and being able to build a program for that child.
Okay, we have a caller on the line. Bill from Columbia is with us. Bill, are you there?
I'm here.
Great. Thanks for joining our program and calling in today.
Hi, Bill.
Thank you. First of all, I think the parents in Columbia are very lucky to have a really great school system. But on a broad philosophical level, I truly think that public schools are the backbone of democracy. And if we want our students to be prepared for the world in which they're going to operate, they're going to need to learn how to interact with and understand the cultures of a lot of very diverse people, and one's going to experience that most of the public schools.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really all my comment.
Okay.
I couldn't agree more. I hope that I touched on that just a little bit when I talked about, you know, that our schools really are. Our board has created school boundaries, almost all of them, where the schools are really made up to be economically diverse. And as a result, our kids in public school are able to interact and be a part of a school community, a school family that really is representative of our community as well as the community around. But in some cases, because of growth, and that may be an area of interest to talk about a little bit, we've had considerable growth in this community where we're adding up to 200 students a year, not just at the lower grades throughout the entire district, because people see community as a place where they want to move.
Right. Bill, I want to thank you for calling in today and sharing your thoughts on the schools. Anyone else who'd like to call in, our number is 573-882-8925. You can join the conversation with Peter Stiepelman, the incoming superintendent of the Columbia Public Schools. I do want to talk about growth because this is one of the huge issues that faces Columbia schools. It's one of the things that we talk about all the time. It's why we keep, as a community, approving bond issues because we have to keep building schools, right?
Right.
Keep showing up. Yeah, so what is the plan for that? I mean, you're going to be inheriting this sort of situation where the district is growing at a rapid pace.
Yeah. You know, one of the things we're most blessed about is that we had a superintendent and a school board that worked really hard to create a 5-year plan for finances and then a 10-year plan for growth and building. And so I'm inheriting a plan that is a really good one that is being monitored and led by our CFO, Linda Quinley. As well as the long-range facility work that is both a board committee, as well as the district leadership. And so you're right, we're growing. The community was incredibly supportive of our last bond measure, passing it by with a 63% vote yes. And that's to allow us to build a school east of town to replace Cedar Ridge. And so as your listeners probably remember or know, Cedar Ridge was built for 100 students. It used to be New Haven North. And so it is now about 200 students. We call it Camp Cedar Hill because of all the trailers that are outside. And there's only one set of bathrooms. So you have all these kids coming in and just sort of doing a dance after lunch each day. And so you have Old Hawthorne is growing out. Rolling Hills Road, where the Vineyards is located, is growing out. An incredible partner to our district is Tom Shawwalker, the county assessor, who's provided incredible maps to be able to show me where growth is happening, where platting has been approved. And so it allows us to kind of look down the road about where we're going to see growth. So in 2018, when we actually open up that school east of town, the bond was just passed. It takes 2 years for that money to become available. So it won't be until 2016 that money becomes available. And then it takes 18 months to build a school. So it's 2018 that school will actually open. And so then we'll have to determine what we do with Cedar Ridge as we open up a school for 650 kids east of town.
Right. And why are bond issues the right way to fund all of this new construction?
It's the only way that you can build that kind of facility it's $28 million to build that school east of town. You would have to make that a substantial capital project for which we don't have that kind of money. And so really it's about establishing sort of like a mortgage. It's about asking your community to allow people to buy your debt. And so because the Columbia Public Schools has an excellent financial plan where we keep at least 16% in reserves, then we have a fabulous bond rating. So our bond rating is AA+, which allows us not only to people want to buy our bond because they are safe and have been safe for a long period of time, but then also that we typically will get a premium when we sell them. We get some money back from the sale of those bonds, for which then we can do things like we have an aging telephone system that needs to be replaced this year. That was going to be about $2 million. That's not money that is just readily available in your operating budget. So then if you were to try to just use it, your operating budget, the money that you get from both the state and local government, from the local entity, from taxpayers, that would mean substantial shifts in what your priorities are. You'd have class sizes that are just beyond compare from what families want, because you'd have to reallocate that money to actually build a school. So this allows us the capacity to do that.
Okay. I want to talk about another one of the sort of key components of the Columbia Public Schools, the teachers that are involved in in providing the education.
May I mention one other thing just about building on, because about buildings? So one of the things that we have done, whether it's the Northeast Elementary School that we're going to open in 2015, Elliott Battle Elementary School, or Southwest, where Thornbrook neighborhood is, or east of town, where Cedar Ridge, to replace Cedar Ridge, each of those three, we've had to purchase land, right? And we've heard loud and clear from our community that, you know, we trust you that we have to do that. But we also want you to be good stewards of our money. And we want you to think more critically about whether or not you need to buy land or can you build onto some schools. And so this summer, we're building onto West Boulevard Elementary School and to Shepherd Elementary School as a way to eliminate trailers and to provide a little additional space for what growth might occur there. And then as a result, our 10-year plan no longer says buy land and build a school, but rather investigate how we could build onto some schools. So maybe we don't need to build a new middle school because you have all this growth at the elementary presupposes that we're going to need some space at the middle schools.
Right.
But could we build onto Gentry? Can you build onto Lang? Can you build onto Smithton? They have property. And so maybe the answer is not about buying land and building, which is expensive, but rather building onto.
Yeah, so, I mean, the challenge with that is as the houses get further and further away from the center of town now, that
that's
for an elementary school, how far do you want the kids
to be driving,
Battle
right? Could be a challenge for the short term, because while we're building it just north of the high school, you really can't walk on St. Charles Road. So you'll have some students who live a stone's throw from the school, but will probably have to provide a bus because they can't. We wouldn't want to ask a five-year-old to walk on St. Charles Road in its current iteration.
Right.
Yeah. So sorry. So you had a teacher's question. But
I thought
it was important to talk a little bit about building on.
No, I appreciate that. And I want to remind everyone first that this is Intersection, a program of KBIA and the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Ruben Stern. I'm filling in for Ryan Familiner today. And we are talking with the next Columbia Public Schools Superintendent, Peter Stiepelman, covering a lot of ground today about education in Columbia. For those of you in our audience, you can join our conversation still. What do you think our schools should be working on over the next few years? Give us a call, 573-882-8925. You can also email us at intersection@kbia.org, or you can tweet us. Our handle is @intersectkbia. I want to talk a little bit about teachers, the role of teachers and what's going on with that. How do you improve the performance of teachers and their enrichment in a way that still maintains respect for the teachers and what they do in the classroom?
Sure. The number one, actually probably number two, but the top three, let's say, positive results on kids' achievement is their teacher. And so we know that there's almost nothing more important. The number one, according to John Hattie, who's a researcher out of New Zealand, is do students believe they themselves can do the work, right? So that apparently has a higher ranking. But truly, we know that the importance of the teacher. And so we know that there's always a debate about class size and about whether it's more important to have 30 kids in a classroom with the best teacher or two teachers who struggle with only 15 kids. Our community has been pretty clear they want small class sizes and they want the high-quality teacher. So that's what we're going to deliver. From my perspective, it's about there are two things. Because we're an urbanizing district, because we have high poverty in our district as compared to even 5 years ago, there are some things to me that are tight. So if you think of it from a loose tight. For me, what is tight is that if we're for writing, for example, if we have three genres of writing that are now associated with the Common Core, you have informational writing, you have opinion writing, and you have narrative writing. As a district, we're going to say this is the window for teaching informational writing, this is the window for opinion, this is the window for narrative. what you choose to do in terms of the text that you choose to use, the materials that you choose to use, that should be in the hands of the professional who's the teacher. But what's tight is when we teach those things. Because, as I described at the first segment of our show, you have between 20 and 30% mobility, in some schools 30. I don't want a kid who leaves Grant School and ends up at Lee to have been now have to learn or to have missed an important genre of writing. That doesn't seem fair to the child. So from a district perspective, there are some things that we have to have that's standardized. But that I wouldn't then suggest what literature a teacher uses to teach that concept or that theme.
Right.
So that to me balances. One of the things that I talked about in my interviews with when I was going through the superintendent search was we provide professional development after school often and on the weekends often. And that is not a model that we should continue doing because you have about the same 30 people who come and participate. And these are people who and that's not to suggest that other people don't care, but they have families. They have lives of their own. They are working really hard during the day with their students. They often give up their own lunch that is supposedly duty-free. But, you know, it means so much to them that this kid be successful or kids be successful that they're tapped out at the end of the day. So really we need to shift, and we had a conversation this morning about how do we make sure that professional development is job-embedded so that whether it's in some type of coaching type of way, not investing in coaches necessarily, but using – there's federal money that we get as a district. It's called title money. And title 2A money is for professional development. So how might we reallocate or use that money instead of bringing in speakers or doing afternoon trainings, but to hire someone who would then present in a classroom model, then come out with the teachers and do a lesson study. What went well? What did you see that what would be a challenge for you? But to see someone teaching your kids is much better than watching a video of somebody else teaching somebody else's kids. So we're going to be exploring how to do that in both math and reading.
And what about the evaluation process? There's a lot of conversation
and
nationally about
that's another hour show.
Teachers.
I mean, because we have right now something called the PBTE, the Performance-Based Teacher Evaluation, for which it's somewhat problematic. You either meet expectations or you don't meet expectations, and there are maybe seven categories. There's a new evaluation model that is being used around the state, and we're interested in, and we know a number of our principals and teachers are interested in it, because what it does is it sets a specific goal. It says, here's my focus as a teacher, or here's my focus as a school, and that's what you're going to evaluate me on. And the evaluation isn't a one-time big event where it's so high stakes, but rather multiple visits into a classroom to be able to give authentic feedback that really sort of pushes the conversation to be about that one area. That's going to be a much better model than what we currently have.
Okay, we will come back on another conversation on that
no,
evaluation
certainly.
Question because I think a lot of people want to talk about that.
I think a lot of people want to talk about it, yeah.
In the meantime, we have a caller on the line who's been waiting patiently, and I want to bring the caller into the conversation. So, Jean, are you with us?
Yes, I am.
Okay, thank you for waiting online and for joining the conversation today.
Thank you. I was calling to ask about preschool. I currently have a grandson who is in kindergarten and doing very well. And he was fortunate enough to be chosen to participate in preschool for 2 years. And really, I think the only reason he managed to get chosen was because he had some speech difficulties, and they worked with him on that and had wonderful results, by the way. But the preschool experience was so positive for him and did such a good job of preparing him for kindergarten that I really feel we really need to expand preschool and make it at least available to all the kids in the district. And I wondered what can be done about that, because I know money is a problem.
That's right. Well,
go ahead.
I'm now going to be your host. So,
no, please. The question was for you, Peter, not for me.
Okay.
So.
Well, Gene, thanks for calling. And I'm glad that your grandson did so well in what is our Title I preschool program. Title I, we operate 26 classrooms right now. We are actually building a facility to open in 2017 on Lang's property. This was part of a bond that was passed in 2012. So we'll be opening up a preschool community there. We have about 625 students who are in our program. We have a wait list. So to Jean's point that more kids would want to participate is true. And she's also right that it costs money. We invest right now $2 million of district money into our Title I program. That's not money we get reimbursed for. So we get reimbursed for K through 12, ADA, average daily attendance. Those kids who attend school, we get a set amount per day for every day that they're there. So there's also the business part of why we want kids to attend school, because we get paid for when they're there. We don't when they're not there. And so I know that Representative Wright, John Wright, is interested in a bill to allow districts to apply for ADA for preschool kids. So I would encourage Gene to write him to say that you support that. But we also want to be thoughtful about what universal preschool might mean for a community that already has rich preschool opportunities, whether it's the Children's House or Trinity Lutheran or Stevens College, or there are lots of great programs in our district. And what we don't want to do is to create an environment where then they are feeling that they're going to be pinched and closed down, because what we're not offering is infant and toddler care in our schools. And they are able to fund the infant and toddler component of their private preschools by the 3 and 4 year olds who attend their preschool program. So the ratio, I think, is 1 to 8 in infant and toddler, and it's far higher in the others. So there's a component there where we want to make sure that we're communicating well with our private providers, as well as offer, as Gene said, to those kids who really would benefit from 2 years of preschool before they come in.
So do you think every kid should have access to preschool?
Oh, I totally do, yeah. In fact, one of the things that John Wright did with the school district is that we started a Montessori preschool program at Grant School. And so it is a private-public partnership. And so maybe that's something that we can explore doing more of, which is where 10 kids, it's 20 kids, 10 kids pay tuition, about $800 a month, and then 10 kids are there on scholarship. And those 10 kids who are on scholarship are mostly kids who are coming out of public housing and who could not afford such a high-quality program like Jean's grandson got. Because she's right, you have to qualify to go to Title I. It's not income-based, but there are points that you get based on different issues, like do you have a parent who is incarcerated, or a parent who has not graduated high school, or a learning disability, like Gene mentioned. So you get points, and then based on those points, if you have at least 3, you can qualify for the program. And certainly they try to have a good blend of kids who have really high points as well as those with lower points. That would be a good mix of kids.
Okay. Gene, thanks again for calling in and joining the conversation today.
Yes, thank you very much.
Okay.
Oh, I didn't know you were still on. Sorry, Gene.
I want to jump off of what you just said about the preschool stuff to talk a little bit more about Achievement Gap and Equal Opportunity Schools and other things that try to conquer some of these issues outside of the classroom in order to ensure achievement across the board.
Yeah.
You've been a proponent of a lot of different kinds of alternative educational ideas.
So I'm glad to have the opportunity again to talk a little bit more about an idea that surfaced more than 10 years ago, which was could Columbia create a Harlem Children's Zone or a Columbia Children's Zone? And Bishop Lawson, as well as a number of other leaders in the community, invited Jeffrey Canada to come to town, and he did. And they talked about, would this be a possibility? Could we eliminate mobility for kids and create a zone where kids could come to school?
So what does that mean exactly?
Okay, so I was at Blue Ridge Elementary School, and a kid said to me, "You are my principal." I was just finishing up some walkthroughs of classrooms. I was looking at writing instruction. And I said, "So how you doing, man?" And he said, "Well, I'm good. I said, so you're at Blue Ridge now." Well, he was my student when I was at West Boulevard. And so he went from Alpha Heart to Cedar Ridge to Blue Ridge. And he says, "And today's my last day." And it was October 1st. Leases are changing over. And he was going to go to Benton. And he's at Benton. I've seen him at Benton. And so I was curious. How do students do if they've been at this school since kindergarten through third grade on the MAP test, the state test, the standardized test? And so if you think about the MAP test, like an A is like an advanced, and proficient is like a B on a report card, and basic is like a C. And I don't want a C for my child, but I might live with it thinking that it is within the basic range. So I'll do advanced, proficient, maybe basic. But I will definitely not accept, nor would I expect anyone to accept, a D or an F, which is below basic on the MAP test. So if you're a kid, you've been at Blue Ridge from kindergarten through third grade, only 4% of you are below basic, which seems to suggest that if you stay there, they do remarkable things for kids. So then I was curious, is that just an anomaly? Is that just Blue Ridge? Or is that just third grade? So we looked K through 4, K through 5, same story. Then we looked at district-wide. If you have been at the same school for those 3 years or 4 years, only 11% of your kids are below basic. So that says to me, if you could provide consistency for a child, that child will be successful. And so we started to do this sort of what if. You've heard of like the what if group, right? Yeah. So I saw them give a TED talk a year ago, and so I started to get kind of excited about this what if. What if we could create a school that eliminated mobility, that was year-round, that was multi-age, that provided enrichment opportunities like foreign language and musical instruments, that may add more days as a year-round component, or just maybe more thoughtful about 9 weeks on, 3 weeks off. And in that three-week intervening time is when they do some substantial enrichment. So you coordinate with trips, and they put on a show within 3 weeks. Those types of things. What if we started not just with preschool, like Gene was suggesting, but infants and toddlers? Or what if we could start talking to those parents now who are pregnant, right? We have teens who are pregnant at Douglas or even in the other two high schools, three high schools. And so what if we could get their infants into our program and we just say, just stay. You don't have to leave. If you want to, go to your home school, that's fine. But what if we could also provide busing throughout the entire district so wherever you live, we'll get you back? And the premise of the Heartland Children's Zone is once you decide to go there, you're in, right? And if you leave, then you leave. But if you stay, we will provide all the service. And so you then engage with the Boone County Family Resources, First Chance for Children, the Columbia Housing Authority, MU Extension. MU Extension moved over to the old Water and Light building on Ash where United Way is. Mm-hmm. And so they're going to have Tuesdays and Thursday clinics. So what if on one of those clinic nights you have a pulmonologist, knowing that poverty and asthma go hand in hand? And so to me, that's pretty exciting, is this idea of a community school, where it's not the public school district running the school, but really it's a community effort. Now, the school board has already approved something called small autonomous schools. It gives schools, the two schools, Lee and Ridgeway right now, the opportunity to self-govern. So that model exists. So you could have a board that sort of self-governs, that's not just the schools. I think it's worth exploring. Now, one of the big issues 10 years ago was we don't have $10 million to build a school. Now it's $28 million to build a school, right? So, but what if, and this is obviously something that the board needs to consider as part of their strategic planning. So we're not announcing anything as part of launching something today, but I think it's worth the conversation because I know Springfield, Missouri has started community school. There's a whole community school coalition that exists throughout the nation. And so what if we took Field, which right now is early childhood downstairs and Gifted upstairs. Now, Gifted used to be in a pretty dumpy spot right by the Catholic Church on Bernadette. It was just a one floor, and we moved into Field. And it's a really nice facility. But what if we moved them out to Cedar Ridge? Right now, there's a building that has bigger classrooms than they're used to. It would fit just right. And then the downstairs is early childhood. Well, we're building that new early childhood site on Lang's property. So maybe three or four of the classrooms go out to Lang, but we retain three for the community school, one of them being a partnership with the Central Missouri Community Action, with the Head Starts. And so there's already sort of a movement that, oh my gosh, this could work. We could do it.
Okay, I'm going to have to stop us there because we are out of time, but we're going to bring you back at some point and have a little more conversation
about this
and dream more about what Columbia Public Schools could be.
I appreciate it.
That's it for our show today. I'd like to thank Peter Stiepelman for joining us today, currently the Assistant Superintendent for Elementary Education and soon to be the Superintendent of Columbia Public Schools. We'd like to remind those of you in our audience that are enjoying this as a rebroadcast that Intersection takes place live for a full hour from 2 to 3 every Monday afternoon. You can watch live streaming video of our program each Monday afternoon online at kbia.org. Alongside the video, you can submit your questions and comments and take part in our online chat with others in the audience. You'll also find the archive of all of our past programs, including the full hour of today's conversation. Intersection is broadcast from the Reynolds Journalism Institute and is a project of RJI and KBIA. Today's program was produced by Bridget Browden and Janet Saidi. Travis McMillan is our technical director with production assistance from Rachel Gangware. Pat Akers is our audio producer. I'm Ruben Stern, filling in for Ryan Fumuliner. Thanks for joining us today, and have a great week.